Subcommittee on Civil Law will come to order, and we have three bills up today and one resolution. I don't see any representatives here, so I'm going to proceed in the manner in which the schedule says, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2591. Counsel, will you explain the bill, please?
Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2591 prohibits individuals from bringing lawsuits based on food-related conditions against companies involved in selling, marketing, or advertising food. It provides exceptions for violations of certain statutes and sets out pleading requirements for such lawsuits.
I understand that there will be some amendments proposed to this bill, therefore we will not proceed to work session. Are there members of the audience that wish to testify on this bill? Just come forward. Please. Morning.
Morning, Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I represent the Oregon Restaurant Association, and obviously we're handing out written testimony, so I will paraphrase and not go through all the things I've written down. We introduced this bill along with Senate Bill 988 to address some things that 14 other states have dealt with in some manner or fashion before January of this year, and some other states are looking at it. I hope as you read the bill and listen to some of the testimony, you understand that we're not obviously trying to relieve all liability. And I do want to say for the record, I appreciate the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association working with us on some hopefully compromise amendments to address their concerns. But by Section 1, Subsection 3, you notice there are conversations in there about we're not trying to alleviate all civil liability or criminal liability. If the food is altered in any way or mislabeled or anything, it still allows lawsuits in that. What we're really talking about here is just strictly lawsuits that are brought about from the consumption of food with no consideration of exercise and other things that all portray into a healthy lifestyle. And also one of the main issues, I think, as we talk about the national companies is Section 3, Subsection 3, which does stay discovery until a motion to dismiss has been dealt with. That is one of the more major concerns that the food companies have. And so with that, I mean, obviously I plan to have more in-depth conversations with the individual members as we get some compromise amendments with the Trial Lawyers Association. But that's really kind of what we're after in this bill. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions for the committee. Chair Krieger? Okay. I just have a couple questions on the... you mentioned that there's legislation at the federal level and that a similar act has passed the United States House of Representatives, and similar act apparently was introduced in the United States Senate. Could you tell us what the progress are of legislation and whether that would preempt state control over these types of claims?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, that was dealt with in the last Congress, so I don't think that it has moved yet in this new Congress. My understanding it's a similar sign of tort, so it would be on a national level. I think the claims are similar, but I don't specifically know if it preempts states from doing different things.
Fine. Thank you. Further questions for the committee? Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Mr. Fessinger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alan Tressiter, and I'm representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And we're here today on House Bill 2591, which, as written, we would have some objections to. But I want to reiterate what Mr. Perry just said, that we are working with him very closely, and we believe that we will achieve amendments that will make the bill acceptable for both parties. I'm distributing some concerns we have with the bill. I'm not going to go through those today, but I just want this committee to know and be assured that the overall goal of what we understand the Restaurant Association to be, we would share that goal, and we will work cooperatively with them to bring a bill to you that satisfies all parties.
Fine. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Hearing none, we thank you for your testimony. Further witnesses on House Bill 2591. As I said, we will not proceed to work session. We'll do the amendments when they come in, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2591 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2634. Council, will you explain the bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2634 establishes pleading requirements for actions against real estate licensees.
We have four people signed up. I assume you're all together since you're all in favor of the bill. You could either come up four at a time or three and one or two and two, however you wish to present your testimony. Ms. Jarvis will come first then. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. House Bill 2634, we bring before you today, and I bring three other witnesses with me to speak to the specific provisions of this bill. And I'll let them introduce themselves, but I'll let you know that I have Matt Farmer with me today, who's a general counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors, Kate Brooke, who's general counsel for RE/MAX Equity and brings to you a very large firm's perspective on the benefits of this bill, and Lee Dunn, a business owner's perspective. So with that, I'll turn in our written testimony and invite them up to the dais.
Fine, thank you. And while that's occurring, Ms. Jarvis and I had a discussion before the meeting, and I had one question I wanted to throw out to the witnesses, particularly those there may be lawyers in the crowd. On page 1, line 7, it appears to apply to claims against real estate licensees that arises out of the, quote, provision of services, close quotes. That wording, provision of services, has no legal meaning to me, and I could comment on that. If it should not be there, we can certainly do an amendment. I think we should try to limit it to claims of professional malpractice against real estate licensees, something of that nature, but I want you to relate to that because I don't recognize the language as being legally significant. Okay, I don't know who wants to testify first. We'll let you go and state your name for the record in any order you prefer.
Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Matt Farmer. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I thank the committee for an opportunity to do this, and I will address your concerns, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2634 is modeled after what was Senate Bill 611 in the last legislative session, which passed into law and has now been effective for 2 years. And it addresses a very narrow issue of civil pleading, and that is how much investigation should lawyers undertake before they make claims against of professional malpractice. The Oregon Association believes that consumers should have every right to pursue legitimate claims of professional malpractice. The problem is, and we see this across professions, is that there's sort of a rush to name everyone in a lawsuit and then hope that those who may have errors and omissions insurance will simply come and buy their way out of the process without respect to whether or not you might actually be able to prove your case. A good example would be in a real estate transaction. Most disputes involve the buyer suing the seller over the condition of the property. That's certainly a legitimate suit. What the lawyers tend to do is name all the agents involved and bring them into mediation or whatever and say, look, it's going to cost you $20,000 to get out of this, even if you're right. So let's reach some kind of an agreement. And they haven't even investigated the issue of professional malpractice. One way to address that, in the way that we think the easiest way to do that, is to require the lawyer to certify, and that's what this bill does, that they have talked to an expert who is willing to testify as to professional malpractice, that is, that the professional's conduct in this case fell below the standard of care and caused the injury. We think that's consistent with modern civil procedures. The architects, we understand from talking to them, have had no problems implementing Senate Bill 611. As to your particular concern, Chairman, I'm not certain why legislative counsel chose this language, and I would share your concern. I think there's a couple of ways to go about it. The one that you suggest, just calling it what it is, and that is professional malpractice. That is actually defined in case law. Or I think you could make reference to professional real estate activity, which is rather well defined in statutes at 696.010.13, if I remember. So either of those ways, I think, would address your concern. And with that, if there are any other questions.
I want to follow up on your suggestion that the wording should be changed maybe to professional real estate activity. What I don't want to do is pick up breach of contract claims, because I don't think you need an expert for that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is, I think, probably the concern that led legislative counsel to draft it in this way, and certainly we'd have to work closely with them to make sure that the intent here is to limit it to those cases in which professional malpractice is pled and must be proved by expert testimony.
Fine, thank you. I think we could accommodate those amendments pretty easily, so obviously we won't proceed to a work session today, but we will finish out the public hearing, the public testimony on the bill. Thank you. Next witness.
Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Brook. I'm general counsel for RE/MAX Equity Group Incorporated. We are a real estate brokerage with 18 offices in Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon. We have nearly 1,100 affiliated agents. Obviously, as general counsel, it's my job to manage claims raised against the company. And let me just tell you that this is not my usual venue. So if I commit an error of politeness or a failure to address anyone properly, or if I should be so bold as to call you Your Honor, please forgive me. It is an unfortunate fact in our world that buyers and sellers often bring claims against RE/MAX Equity Group even if they have no specific facts or basis in law for doing so. While I want to make it very clear that RE/MAX is not attempting to avoid liability for such claims or to discourage consumers to bring legitimate claims against our company by supporting this legislation, most of the claims, nearly 80% in my experience, are raised for only one reason, and that is because we will pay settlement funds to avoid the greater cost of proving that our agents did no wrong. Examples of the kinds of claims that are raised against us abound. I have simply picked the last five that hit my desk. One claimant sought damages resulting from an agent's errors and omissions and failure to act in an unbiased manner, but did not tell us what those errors or omissions may be and did not indicate what acts were biased on the part of our agents. I have yet to find out the answer to that question. Similarly, another attorney stated that our agent representing the buyer may not have communicated information appropriately. Again, I do not yet know what information that might be, nor when we should have or may have communicated it. A third provided that Equity Group failed to disclose possibly known defects. I have asked for that information from the claimant's attorney. I do not yet know what defects we're talking about. And the final two claimants simply brought us into the matter without bothering to state any basis at all for their claim. It's clear that Equity Group and other brokerages, big and small, are considered to be deep pockets in this case simply because we have E&O insurance. In one case, a buyer raised claims against us, which we proved in simple discussions prior to any claim being filed that we could defeat on the basis of eyewitness testimony. The attorney nonetheless suggested that we should pay his client something because his case is worth something on a nuisance basis. In line with Mr. Farmer's testimony, attorneys frequently simply name us because we are another source of funds for their client. In perhaps my most humorous example, an attorney representing a buyer sent us a demand for funds which he claimed our agent failed to put into escrow or to cause to be put into escrow. At one point in the transaction, a seller had offered to put some money into escrow to guarantee his performance in the matter. The attorney suggested that we should pay that money to his client, even though we didn't represent the seller. We represented the buyer and so could not compel the seller's performance, even though the buyer had stated that he did not want the escrowed funds in lieu of performance, and even though I had advised the attorney 30 days previously that the money was, in fact, in escrow and available to his client. In the 6 months that I've been with RE/MAX, I estimate that something around 80% of the claims raised against us, whether formally or informally, are frivolous. Again, we have no desire to discourage legitimate claims. However, Equity Group supports House Bill 2634 because we believe that it will cause claimants and lawyers to investigate and substantiate their claims prior to bringing them against us. House Bill 2634 will eliminate, we believe, unsubstantiated claims and allow us to focus our efforts on resolving the legitimate claims that are raised against us and to educate our agents to provide better service to the consumer. I would be glad to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Questions from the committee to the witness? Okay. Representative McPherson?
Yeah, I have a question, and I'm not sure who it should be directed to, and maybe we should wait for the third person.
Yeah, let's do it. That's a good suggestion. I'll take the testimony from the final witness, and then we'll open it up for questions. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Lee Dunn. I'm with Prudential Northwest Properties. I'm licensed in both Oregon and Washington, and I've been a broker in the state of Oregon in a management position since 1981. Over that time frame, I've managed 12 different branch locations to mortgage brokerage, president of the Lute Snyder Company that was the 23rd largest real estate company in the United States at the time. Most of my career I've spent taking a look at risk reduction, and over the last 7 or 8 years, liability costs relating to claims have escalated dramatically. And at this point in time, we look at the cost of defending a claim as opposed to the justification of the claim in the settlement practice. In other words, right now I can tell you that in our company, our average cost of settlement is about $7,000. When we make the settlement. To go on to arbitration is a cost of about $15,000, and that's just for the cost of the arbitration itself. That doesn't have anything to do with the claim. And so when we have a claim filed, we take a look at that $15,000 cost, and we're going to make a settlement, whether it's justified or not, based on the fact that arbitration is hanging over our head. And so that's encouraged people to make claims, and some of them are very justified. We try to settle those as quickly as possible, but we do have an awful lot of frivolous claims now that we deal with. In the past, on 10,000 transactions a year, it would be customary to see somewhere between 24 and 36 claims. Today, it would not be uncommon to see 24 claims over a quarter. And have to deal with those issues. And yet, the practice of real estate has improved dramatically over the last 10 years as far as the quality of the practice and the people that are practicing in the business. So I'm in favor of this legislation because it would put some qualification into some of these claims. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll open up the questions now since all the witnesses testified. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just throw this out to the panel and let whoever who has the best information respond. The bill refers to a claim against a real estate licensee that arises out of the provision of services within the course and scope of the activities for which the person is licensed. Educate me a little bit about how the individual real estate broker is licensed and how that relates to the license. I think there's a license at the brokerage level, but I'm a little fuzzy about that. So educate me a little bit about those relationships.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, Oregon has just recently, within the last 4 years, moved towards what is called single licensing. In the past, the real estate company was licensed. There would be a broker who was separately licensed, and then each of the individual agents would have been licensed. Under the present system, the new system, everybody, only individuals are licensed, much like in the bar. Individuals, you know, are members of the bar. Individuals are licensed to practice real estate, and not companies anymore. So the suit here would likely name the company, but it would be based on the malpractice of the individual. And because they are professionally licensed, the standard of care is that they didn't exercise the diligence of an ordinary licensee in similar circumstances, and that's what drags in the licensing.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And if, I'm sorry, sir, if I may add.
Sure, please.
The agents affiliate with the brokerages by contract, and brokerages provide E&O insurance for each of their contracted licensees. And therefore, any claim against a licensee is a claim against the insurance. We have an obligation to defend each of our licensees, and that's how brokerages are brought into disputes.
My follow-up question, and this is maybe just a question of massaging the language, but if the individuals are licensed, and but the lawsuit is being filed against the agency within which they work, then is there a question about whether a claim that is names the agency would be subject to this requirement? It may well be that one could say, well, the claim arises because of the relationship between the individually licensed agent and the company that that agent works with. But I would want to make sure we were accomplishing what the purpose was, which is to make sure that the agency could invoke this requirement that there be expert information.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McPherson, the committee members, maybe I can clarify the issue a little bit. In each company, there's a registered principal broker. And that's the person that owns the company, registers the name of the firm. That person has supervisory responsibility and accountability for everything that occurs in that company, right down to the actions of all the individual licensees that are licensed through his organization. That delegation from that registered principal broker can be given to another principal broker. We call them branch managers, and they in turn have responsibility for supervision, but ultimately the accountability stays with the firm for all actions and all issues involving the practice.
Representative McPherson, maybe this would help. The company is brought in because the individual real estate licensee is acting on the company's behalf, and so really it's more like vicarious liability. It's not exactly the same claim, but it's along those lines. And I think, though, that your unease might have something to do with the same issues that the chairman expressed at the beginning of this hearing that we're going to deal with, and that is, how do we make sure that the object of this legislation is professional malpractice alone, and we get it covered, and so I hopefully we can take care of that, those two concerns together.
Thank you. That's very helpful, and I would really was to try to draw out that information so that as long as we're tinkering with language, we can make sure that it gets to the point you're trying to get to.
Fine. Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, I thank you for your testimony. Are there any other persons wishing to testify on this bill? Otherwise, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2634 and you can talk to me at the conclusion of the hearing today or later about potential amendments. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2730. Counsel, will you explain the bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2730 provides civil immunity for radio or television broadcasters who participate in the Amber Plan.
I see Representative Garag. And are there other witnesses that would like to come forward at this time? I have sort of in brackets three people from the OAB. Do you want to come up to the panel after Representative Garag? Let's do that then.
Okay.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Garag. I'm State Representative, District 56. As a former broadcaster who still maintain ties to the industry, I support House Bill 2730 and would at this point introduce Mr. Fiskum and members of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters to discuss the bill with you.
I'll come forward, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative. You're looking forward to questioning him.
Well, I'm out of that chair.
Yeah, I was disappointed that he got up so fast.
He knows his way around.
You're saving the hard questions for me. Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, several hundred stations around the state on both radio and TV levels. We're here to support, as Representative Garag has said, House Bill 2730, and I wanted to thank Representative Garag for being willing to have this bill drafted at our request. We appreciate his support in that regard. My main role today is to introduce to you two persons on my right, who are Bill Johnstone, the President and CEO of our association, as well as then to his right, Dom Monahan, who is the legal counsel for our association, and to the extent that he may have questions about this, the issues embedded in House Bill 2730 from a legal perspective, Dom would be well able to answer them. I would just say one other thing. We understand that there are some issues surrounding amendments to this bill that may be proposed, and Mr. Chair, we'd be pleased to deal with those at your discretion in the course of the next moments. But with your indulgence, I think maybe the place to start would be to let us make a statement about why we appear before you today.
Fine, thank you. And you'll certainly have an opportunity to develop that. I wanted to just ask one question, and then we'll go into your testimony, and perhaps it will draw out the answer. I need to know whether you believe there's an Article 1, Section 10 infirmity in the House bill, because it does grant absolute immunity to broadcasters under certain situations. I don't know the answer to that, except any time immunity is asked for, I always understand it's an Article 1, Section 10 problem. So I'd like that addressed, if we can do that today.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to address that either now or at the end of our testimony, because knowing of your interest in that, as well as the possibility of others with your staff's counsel is alerting us to that, we're prepared to answer that today. So it may be better to do that in a few moments, but...
No, just proceed with your testimony. I just threw that out for consideration. I'll either you can relate to it or we'll develop it in the question-answer period.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bill Johnstone, President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and we're here today to encourage the passage of House Bill 2730. Legislation would provide civil immunity to radio and television broadcasting stations and organizations participating in voluntary Amber Alert broadcasts. As a way of explanation, in the event of a child abduction, the way the Amber Alert process works in Oregon is that a call is placed to a 911 center. That call is then relayed to the appropriate local law enforcement agency or the Oregon State Police. The Oregon State Police then investigate the validity of the call and make a determination in the abduction if the abduction fits the Amber Alert criteria. If it does, the Oregon State Police then advise the Oregon Emergency Management Office to issue a statewide Amber Alert, and this alert is then sent to every radio and television station in the state of Oregon. To date, the system has worked very well, and the state police, county, and local law enforcement agencies have successfully recovered all Amber Alert victims in Oregon. So why do we need House Bill 2730? Well, the problem is this. Broadcasters are concerned that since they air the Amber Alerts voluntarily and since they play no part in determining the validity of an alert, it is possible that they could be held accountable if a recovery does not occur in response to an Amber Alert. Broadcasters fear exposure to legal action from the victim, the family, or someone else in the community. If this were to happen, it obviously would have a very chilling effect on future Amber Alerts. The broadcasters are the vehicle by which the Amber Alert is transmitted to the police, to the public, and have no input or responsibility to the content of the alert. The validity of the and the content of the Amber Alert are the responsibility of the Oregon State Police and the Oregon Emergency Management. For these reasons, the Oregon Association of Broadcasters is seeking, on behalf of their members, immunity from any and all liability arising from an Amber Alert broadcast in Oregon. To be sure, this approach is designed to prevent problems from occurring. The bill we are seeking does not respond to any particular or specific problems that have occurred to date. Furthermore, a total of 10 states have enacted similar legislation in an attempt to protect the broadcasters. And I thank you for your time and would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is take the questions at the end so the third witness can proceed.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Monahan is here to answer your questions as opposed to make a statement for the record, and so this may be a good time, with your permission, for us to deal with your question that you asked initially.
Certainly, any time.
Yes. Mr. Chair, my name is J. Dominic Monahan. I serve as counsel to the OAB. In response to your question as to providing immunity to the broadcaster under Amber Alerts, and whether or not that violates Section 10, the right to a remedy, we believe it does not, because the active participant in issuing an Amber Alert is the Oregon State Police or the emergency agency. We serve simply as a passive conduit. In the event that an Amber Alert should misidentify an individual resulting in a false arrest or a form of defamation or libel, we believe the aggrieved party would clearly have a right under the Oregon Tort Claims Act to pursue the state agency. We merely seek immunity from such a suit, but not without denying the aggrieved party a right to seek some redress for the injury to his person or reputation.
Fine, thank you. Any further statements from the panel? And I'll see if we have other questions from the committee. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to yield to a question or make one more comment for the record before I move back, but
we'll go ahead.
I just want to make sure you understood that Mike Dewey, who represents the Oregon Cable TV Association, intended to be here today. If he came in behind me, I'll let him speak for himself. But one of the points that he and I have talked about is that for purposes of this bill, should we move on this bill, he would like the definition of broadcast to include cable. And from the standpoint of our association, we have no difficulty with that. However, that would be achieved. And he asked me to make that statement for the record.
Fine. Thank you. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Monahan, I need to get a better understanding about the constitutional issue that the chair raised, and it sounds like your response, at least it suggests to me, that if a remedy is allowed against someone, it's okay then under our Constitution to deny the remedy as against somebody who's acting together with that person against whom the remedy continues. And I that may be an appropriate interpretation of the Constitution. I just need a better grounding in those issues. So I'd say if you have anything more to offer, great. But if there's some more authoritative source that we could look to for guidance on that, that would be helpful to my understanding about just where we can go, because we're getting an increasing number of these kinds of proposals to insulate certain actors from liability when they participate in something that might generate claims.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I believe the role of the broadcaster or the cable system in the issuance of an Amber Alert is akin to being an agent of a state agency. And although I don't have the case at my fingertips right now, I'm certainly willing to provide it, where I believe the court here in Oregon has ruled that agents of a state agency can be exempted from liability, provided the aggrieved party is permitted to pursue the particular agency who allegedly engaged in the tortious action.
Thank you.
Thank you,
I was thinking about what you're saying. Counsel, do you have a question?
If I could make a or ask a quick question regarding that. If the action was brought and had nothing to do with the police action, but it was for negligence or something on the behalf of the radio broadcaster, so the action was against the broadcaster, not as an agent for the state, would there be a problem with this? Would there be a constitutional issue?
Mr. Chair and counsel, I find it hard to envision that happening because the broadcaster has no involvement in the composition or the creation of the message which is aired by the broadcaster for the cable system. In the unlikely event that somehow a broadcaster or a cable system should intervene prior to the state police message being aired, I'm not so sure what we seek here would immunize that broadcaster or cable system, because then they become an active participant in a message that they obviously have a role in creating, and if that results in some form of defamation or leads to some injury to an aggrieved party, I wouldn't envision this proposed legislation providing immunity to that particular media outlet that chose to interfere with the mission, with the message as originally composed by the state police.
Mr. Chair, committee, if I could interject a thought.
Sure.
In the process, as I had outlined earlier in my comments, when that Oregon Emergency Management or state police decide to activate an Amber Alert, it is activated over the state EAS, Emergency Alert System. That system is not a manual system. When the Oregon Emergency Management decides to issue an Amber Alert, they simply push a button which activates the voiced alert voiced by either Oregon Emergency Management or a member of the Oregon State Police, and that alert, and that's that obnoxious sound that you hear on your radio and television set when they do an alert or a practice alert, and it simply goes out over the air. The broadcaster doesn't interfere with that message at any point. Now, after the alert, and we asked in our Amber committee, we asked stations to, for the first hour, activate that alert, or repeat that alert, pardon me, four times, once every quarter hour for the first hour, and then once every half hour for the next 2 hours, or until they cancel the alert because the child or the victim has been found. So at no time in the process does the broadcaster interfere with the wording of the alert. They simply make sure that their piece of equipment is on and active, and when the button is pushed, the alert goes out over the air.
If that is so, it seems as if the risk is very minimal of litigation then. So my question is, either statewide or nationwide, what are the instances in which broadcasters are sued successfully?
Mr. Chair and committee, at this point, to my knowledge, there has been no litigation. But as 10 previous states have passed this legislation in their states as protection to their broadcasters, Oregon is similarly looking to do the same thing.
Thank you.
Representative Girard. Just point out to the chair and the committee that being an old-time broadcaster, 40 years ago, we, the broadcasting industry, were liable in reading the weather forecast that came locally if it injured a farmer or something along those lines. So I think this is somewhat an exaggeration, but if the message is wrong, if there's something wrong in the message, that's what the broadcasters need to be covered on. It's not what they in essence say, but it's what's in that message. And from time to time, there's a state agency that messes up. So.
Okay. Representative Worth?
I'm going to ask a question from a layperson's point of view. And I guess getting at the same confusion here. If the main concern in terms of causing egregious to someone is due to a mistake made in the message, and there's no responsibility or any connection with you, with the message, how then would your act or omission cause a problem? Are you more concerned about being held liable if a victim is not found, or being held liable because something in the Amber Alert system goes awry and some third party is negatively affected?
Mr. Chair and Representative Worth, let me respond to that. I think it's possible to envision alleged claims arising out of both hypotheticals that you pose. The state police message or the Oregon Emergency Agency message, for instance, may misidentify an alleged abductor, misjuxtaposition the license plate numbers. That's often a key factor in an Amber Alert, resulting in the arrest of an individual who clearly shouldn't have been arrested. The other factor, or the other hypothetical you pose, in the perhaps a delay or a failure to get an Amber Alert out may give rise to a set of facts. Someone wants to allege that the parties who had an obligation or had been properly notified that an abduction had occurred, but for whatever reason there's a delay in transmitting that message, and facts later determine that had it been timely, perhaps it would have led to a successful rescue, but doesn't, and perhaps child is killed or lost. And these are all hypothetical. But in response to an earlier question as to what anecdotal evidence we may have that there's a need for this kind of protection to the broadcaster or the cable system, I believe it arose in the state of Illinois. There was no lawsuit filed, but there was misinformation involved in an Amber Alert message, which resulted in the stopping of a vehicle. A person was not arrested, but obviously was quite angry at the fact that an Amber Alert had led to really an unjustified stop of his vehicle. And it caused some concern within the broadcast community in Illinois, and I think that's what gave rise originally to the idea of why the broadcaster, who serves as a passive conduit, should be subject to a possible lawsuit. But there was no lawsuit in that case, but it's what sparked the idea.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, that helps a lot. So just tell me if I've got this correct. So I guess in my mind, to be liable for something, you have to be responsible for it. So, the mistake in relaying the license plate by the state police, that's not under your control at all, because that message is dictated by the state police. And then the delay in getting the message out, again, that's not under your control at all, because the button is pushed and it's just sent out. So neither of those situations are an act or omission of an act by the broadcaster. So if you're not responsible for I don't see how that would be. Can you give me an example of what an act or omission of the broadcaster would be, because I don't see how you have any control over either of those situations, and therefore how could you be held liable if you...
Mr. Chair and Representative Worth, I cannot, in today's world, envision the broadcaster having committed an act or failed to act. But what I can readily envision is that a person who believes they have been aggrieved by the Amber Alert system will not only file a claim or suit against the agency responsible for dispersing the message, but the other characters that are involved in the process. So it may be akin to testimony here on a former bill where people seek to limit the claims being filed against them because they prove really to be frivolous, but that does not stop people from filing lawsuits.
Thank you.
Fine. Further questions from the committee? Okay, thank you for your testimony. We have any other, we have Alan Tressiter, anyone else besides Mr. Tressiter that would like to testify on the bill? All right, I'll excuse you, gentlemen, and take Mr. Tressiter's testimony.
Chair, thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Alan Tressiter, representing the Oregon Trawler Association. Just a couple of comments on House Bill 2730. And I would tell the committee I've also spoken with the bill's sponsor, Representative Garrard, and with the proponents of the bill, the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. If you're going to move forward with this bill, we'd like to see you add an additional section, and I apologize for not having written amendments for you, but our legislative committee looked at this bill late last evening, so I don't have those yet, but a new section which would say that the immunity conferred by subsection 3 of this act does not protect the broadcaster from civil liability where the broadcaster's act or omission was reckless, intentional, or malicious. In other words, narrowing the blanket immunity that is granted in the bill as printed, and simply if you're reckless, intentional, or malicious, you don't get immunity. And the other point I wanted to make is, as printed, the bill is retroactive. In line 14 of the printed bill, it says this covers acts whether occurring before, on, or after the effective date. This body generally does not adopt retroactive legislation, and we would ask you to delete the word before so that it only applies to acts that occur on or after. And I think I understood the proponents of the bill saying there's been no litigation filed. And I don't certainly know of any that's intended, so I think that doesn't affect the intent of the bill at all. And that's my testimony.
Fine. Questions? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The previous testimony said that he has mentioned that he cannot think in today's world of any act or omission by a broadcaster that would qualify. And so can you think of any potential, and this is basically precluding
right.
anything from ever coming up in the future.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, we actually sat around a table last night with our legislative committee looking at this bill and going, what could happen here? I mean, it did cause some puzzlement among our members of, yes, we can think of things that might happen. I think the gentleman before me just gave an example of you broadcast a wrong license plate number, somebody is stopped, pulled out of their vehicle, maybe have to go through a fairly embarrassing search, and if it was the wrong license number, they may feel aggrieved. And if you're a party who has been injured, you're going to name all the parties to that action because you're not going to know who was responsible until you go through a discovery phase and see who did what. And I can understand where the broadcasters don't want to be in that chain. We didn't come up with any real clear, solid what might happen other than a misidentification, misnaming a child, things like that that would be...
Which are not really an act of omission of the broadcaster.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Fine. May not be an act of omission of the broadcaster.
Thank you, Representative. Yep. Further questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tressiter, can you shed any further light on this constitutional question when we start cutting off remedies and how that stands under the Oregon Supreme Court's position on,
sure.
on the remedies clause.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, as you know, the court has in a recent time suggested that an injured party's right to a trial by jury is inviolate, that nothing that this body does can abrogate a right of an injured party to have a jury trial. There is a substantial body of thought among my members that that extends to things like granting immunity, that just because the legislature says you're immune from action does not mean you're immune from action. There are cases directly on that point that are winding through the system, and I believe within the next couple of years the Supreme Court will definitively guide us on what they meant by that. Generally speaking, of course, my members do not like granting immunity because that gets a possible responsible party off the hook for being responsible for their actions, and it denies an injured party the right to recover for their injuries from all of the persons who might be involved in those injuries. I think the answer to your question is it depending on how you read Lakin v. Senko, for example, that may not resolve all of your questions. I think the Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court at least, has strongly suggested that a right of an injured party to have a jury trial cannot be abrogated by this body.
Thank you, Mr. Chester. Further questions? If I understand your proposal, it would eliminate negligent claims against broadcasters under the situation. Is that my reading of your proposal? And confine it to a reckless gross negligence?
Yeah, we're not going to grant them immunity. We would hope you would not grant immunity for reckless or intentional or malicious acts.
Okay. So. And will you be offering an amendment to that effect?
I'm sorry, Mr.
You'll be offering an amendment to
yes.
that effect?
Okay. Yes. With counsel's help, we'll get an amendment drafted by Legislative Council.
Fine. Further questions then from the committee. Further testimony on House Bill 2730.
Here, Dave Fiskin for the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Just very briefly, I have had discussions with my friend Mr. Tressiter, and in both of the cases he mentions the reckless issue and the retroactive issue. We have no difficulty with those changes which are proposed. I will leave to your counsel and others the issue that relative to the constitutional question, which we can resolve somehow. But I wanted to say for the record that the two changes Mr. Tressiter has suggested are fine with our association.
Fine. Then what we'll do is we'll wait for your amendments. I was going to ask counsel to give us some help on the constitutional issue, but I think what I'd rather do is review the amendments when they come in, and then if I have to engage counsel for that, we'll get back to you. Further testimony on House Bill 2730? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2730 and open a public hearing on HCR 7. Counsel, would you explain the resolution, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, HCR 7 declares May 2nd to May 8, 2005 as Jury Appreciation Week in Oregon.
We have one person signed up, Katie Lane. Would you like to come forward? And Representative, good to see you this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You may proceed in any manner you see fit.
And committee for hearing this resolution. I'm Brad Avakian, State Representative, Northeast Washington County. And seated next to me is Katie Lane, who is an assistant county attorney with Multnomah County and the brainchild of this, what I think will be a spectacular week for the Capitol, and also who wrote the resolution. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I will just let Ms. Lane give a 2 to 3 minute statement that she's prepared, and that will suffice for our testimony.
Fine. Thank you, Representative. You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Katie Lane. I also serve as the chair for the Multnomah Bar Association's Community Law Week, and that's what's inspired me to testify here today. But I would just like to make clear that I am not testifying on behalf of either Multnomah County or the Multnomah Bar Association. I'm here as a private citizen, and the views that I express are my own. In planning events for Community Law Week with other lawyers, I have come to appreciate our jury system and have recognized the fact that it is an integral part of our self-government that makes us a stronger people. And that is why I'm here to support House Concurrent Resolution 7, recognizing May 2nd through the 8th as Jury Appreciation Week in Oregon. As he journeyed through a young and considerably smaller United States, Alexis de Tocqueville reflected on the uniqueness of how Americans had decided to lead themselves with democracy. In his book, Democracy in America, de Tocqueville championed the jury and the benefits the institution brought an adolescent but enthusiastic society. He said, "The jury, which is the most energetic means of making the people rule, is also the most efficacious means of teaching it how to rule well. The jury may be regarded as a public school, ever open, in which every juror learns his rights." 25 years later, when a group of no-nonsense, independent settlers met in Salem to hammer out a constitution for what would soon be the state of Oregon, the importance of the jury remained a passionate topic. In his text, The Oregon Constitution, Charles Henry Carey recounted the Oregon Constitutional Convention's debate on the proper role of the jury in criminal trials as one of the most interesting, lengthy, and animated discussions of the entire convention. The participants spent portions of many days discussing the importance of juries in criminal trials alone, and they debated the proper balancing of powers between judges and juries, the inherent power of the people, and the necessity of thoughtful contemplation in assessing justice. In the years that have followed since those debates, Oregon has changed considerably, but the role of the jury in our government remains an important issue. The jury serves as an independent check in the balancing of powers, promising every citizen that comes before it a thoughtful assessment of his or her legal grievances. Those that serve as jurors make it possible for our form of judiciary to continue, and it is proper that Oregonians recognize them for their contributions. It is also proper that this committee, and ultimately the legislature as a whole, encourage Oregonians to serve as jurors, because through such service we are provided with a more educated, compassionate, engaged, and thoughtful citizenry. Oregon's proud history underscores the importance of citizens involving themselves in government, either through the holding of office, participation in the initiative system, or attendance at public meetings. Oregonians know that involvement in government produces a more engaged citizenry, and a more engaged citizenry produces better government. It's appropriate for the legislature to recognize those that serve as jurors and to encourage all Oregonians to involve themselves in government by serving on juries. Because of the benefits of the jury system to all Oregonians, I support House Concurrent Resolution 7, and I urge this committee to do the same. Thank you very much for your time and the permission to testify here today.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, that's a good sign. And anyone else wishing to testify on HCR 7, could you come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on HCR 7 and open a work session on HCR 7. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 7 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion from the committee?
Actually, I don't think I can do that. I think I'm not.
I think it's got to be a member. My enthusiasm is carrying me away, but I guess I'm not technically a member of this.
Representative, you're out of order.
I was going to bring up that question, Mr. Chair.
That got by me. That's okay.
Well, I was raising my pencil.
Okay, Representative Gerard.
Mr. Chair, I would move HCR 7 to the floor, rather to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores is excused. Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Appleman?
Aye.
HCR 7 is forwarded to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. And I'm going to recommend that Representative Varkian be the carrier to I'll carry the bill to the full committee. I'll make the recommendation that you carry the bill on the floor.
Thank you, Mr.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Further business before the committee this morning? Seeing none, we're adjourned.
Sorry about that, Bob.
You're a lawyer.